The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And today, former WCW and WWE announcer Tony Schiavone, or Schiavone, as I used to call him, makes his Talk as Jericho debut. We're talking all about his days with WCW, his brief one-year stint at WWE. He's talking about why he made the jump to WCW after such a short run with Vince McMahon, how Vince reacted to Tony's leaving, and what led to WCW's decline and eventual end. Tony's also talking about why he quit the business cold turkey after WCW, and how he came back into the business through his podcast, What Happened When, with Conrad Thompson. We love Conrad on the show, obviously. Tony's done a lot of great stories about his early days at Jim Crockett Promotions, Hulk Hogan and the NWO, the Monday Night Wars, his infamous line on WCW TV when Mick Foley was made WWE champion, and working and traveling with Bobby the Brain Heenan. So let's get to it. Tony Schiavone on Talk is Jericho, starting now.
We are here. So for the first time, I think, in about 20 years, the big reunion of Schiavone.
How about that?
And Chris Jericho. Tony Schiavone is here. But yeah, man, 20 years, seems, as the maid knocks on the door right now. I was gone for 2 hours waiting for you guys, but now I'm doing an interview, so you have to come back later. The real behind-the-scenes stuff. But so yeah, like 20 years
I know.
Since I saw you last.
Okay.
Watch, let's get this live on the thing. Hey, you have to come back later. Yeah. I don't know. I'll call down. I called down 2 hours ago and you guys never came. So, okay, great. Thanks.
All right. Life on the road, right?
Exactly. Life on the road.
Absolutely.
But, yeah, I think I left WCW in 99.
Right.
And that's literally the last time that I saw you.
Right. Because, and then WCW closed in 2001, mm-hmm. and I went completely cold turkey on the business.
Yeah, I was just going to say, because it just seems like recently there's been the big return of Tony Schiavone. You have a podcast
right,
now, and you've
right.
kind of been doing interviews. And
right.
What made you go cold on wrestling, and then what made you want to come back?
Well, when WCW went down, I really think, well, I know that there was no want for me by Vince McMahon.
Mm-hmm.
I had worked for him for a year in 89.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I left. I know he was very unhappy when I left because I think that he thought I was going to be a big part of his company.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of walked away from it and went back to WCW. It was Jim Crockett Promotions before then, but then it became WCW.
Right.
He was upset about that. And I don't think he held a grudge. I think that combined with the fact that, Chris, I don't think my work was that great at the end.
Mm-hmm.
At WCW. I thought I was overhyping. I thought I was overselling. I didn't like my work. So he didn't want me. And it was pretty clear because I would call and then I would call Kevin Dunn and no one would return my call. So pretty much scratched that off. And I didn't want to go the independent route. So I got a job. Actually, I got the day that WCW closed, I got a job for a radio station in Atlanta. So I just decided, you know what? I'm just going to reinvent myself. I'm going to just walk away from the business. I had a lot of money saved up, and I'm just going to see if I can't land on my feet, which I did.
Mm-hmm. You're commentating like Braves games and stuff?
I do the Braves AAA team, right. Which used to be in Richmond. It's now here in Gwinnett County. When I first left, I did the Atlanta Braves pregame and postgame shows on the network. I now work for the Georgia Bulldogs, and I'm a producer on their network. So I've got a lot of things going on, and I work for a radio station in Atlanta. We had you on as a guest just this past week. So I had a lot of things going on, and I just said, you know what? It's a new Tony Schiavone, and I'm going to walk away from it. The theory was that I was bitter about the business. That was not true. I love the business. I grew up loving the business. So for people to say I was bitter about the business was wrong.
Well, so. It's like we just mentioned Don Callis before we started talking. It was the same with him. And he worked WWE, then he worked a big part of ECW. But then when WCW closed, then ECW closes, and you're not going back to WWE. What other recourse do you do but have to go and find something else? Because
right.
there was only two or three companies to
right.
work for.
Right.
So, you know, some guys, I mean, J.J. Dillon's the same. One.
Right.
When all the chances dry up, you got to
right.
still make a living, right?
Right.
So
I didn't want to go to the independent route because I had thought and had heard that there were a lot of shady people out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me that if I would just do independent stuff, that I was just trying to hang on to my old life.
Right.
I want to be seen as someone just trying to hang on.
So when did you come back to, you know, get back involved in the business now in 2017-18?
Well, Conrad Thompson, who did a podcast with Ric Flair, was doing the Woo Nation with Ric Flair. And Flair decided, I guess he didn't want to do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We all know Rick. His attention span is 1 month, right?
I think he figured he was going to make $500,000 a year on it.
Yeah, right.
Reality came in, right?
Exactly. So as you know, to do these podcasts, you got to be determined and you got to do it.
Hustle, man.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Every week, right.
Right. And so that didn't last. And Conrad, the first of last year, the first of 2017, contacted me and said, would you like to do a podcast? And I said, probably not. And he sent me this email, which was very thorough and very laid out about, you know, you can make some money doing this. And I went, well, okay, well, no one wants to hear what I got to say. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I think you'll be surprised. And our daughter, this was like January 15th, maybe. Our daughter had gotten engaged the Christmas before, and she wanted to get married. And I really want to, because I have four boys and she's my only daughter, I really want to give her a nice wedding, because she grew up with four boys. She grew up in a boy household.
Right.
It's time to do something really nice for her.
Yeah.
So the timing was right. You know, extra money for my daughter's wedding. My wife, Lois, said, why not give it a shot? And I found out that people did and was interested in some of the things I had to say and some of the stories and some, because right now, nostalgia is big. For kids who grew up in the 90s, back when the Monday Night Wars, it's really, really big.
So what is the concept of your podcast? Because it's called What Happened When?
What Happened When? The concept is we're really off the chain a lot. I mean, I do some really silly stuff. I let people know my personality, which I think you knew it. Most people knew it. It was not really the straight guy. I was so I try to be funny and irreverent. And what we've done now, we have been doing most of the time, we will invite fans to go to the network. And like, for instance, Russell War 91 and hit play with us. And we will watch the show together. And I will make funny comments and commentary, and I will talk over guys doing interviews and things like that. And we intersperse, you know, stories from back then. Mm-hmm. So it's real different than anybody's interview. We don't interview anybody. We
it's
just
a different
do
style.
A
style. Yeah, just commentary.
It's kind of like Mystery Science Theater 3000 doing wrestling.
Gotcha.
But you don't have to watch it along with us, because you can get some very good information without doing that.
Just to hear it, right?
Yeah, so it's kind of different.
Because you were with you mentioned Jim Crockett Promotions, which was NWA.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And then into WCW for how many years total with all of them put together?
From 93 to 89, I was with Jim Crockett Promotions.
Right.
A year with Vince. And then from 90 to 2001, I was with WCW.
1990 to 2001. Wow, how did you get? Had you been involved in the wrestling business before that, or how did you get involved?
I was doing baseball for the Crockett family. They owned a baseball team in the 80s in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I was a big fan because that was the area I grew up in, the Carolinas and Virginia, and I was a big fan of wrestling. And as I was doing baseball in the early 80s. I kept telling the Crockett family, I said, let me do wrestling. I'd love to do it. I can do it. And they let me do it. And then like 2 years later, maybe three years later, I was doing wrestling part-time, baseball full-time, and making twice as much part-time in wrestling as I was baseball. So they finally said, would you like to do wrestling for us full-time? And I said, sure. And that was when we first started on TBS in 1985.
Okay, so when you started, because you know, we'll get into kind of the catalyst of what made the Monday Night Wars so big, but when you started with, you said, like, you know, Crockett Promotions in 85, it was kind of the secondary company to Vince, right?
Sure.
As it started rolling. So what kind of shows were you doing? Just Saturday Night? Is that what it was? WCW Saturday Night, it was called?
It was called
Georgia.
It was called World Championship Wrestling.
Gotcha. Yeah.
We were doing two shows back then before 1985 when I was working part time. We were doing Worldwide Wrestling. And we were doing Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling. Those were the two shows. Mm-hmm. We had two syndicated shows. Then Vince sold his time slot to Jim Crockett in the early part of 1985. And we started doing World Championship Wrestling on TBS, 2 hours at 6:05 on Saturday night. Mm-hmm. And we also did a show Saturday mornings called Championship Wrestling. Mm-hmm. And we would record those on Saturday morning. And We would record 3 hours of TV on Saturday morning, and we would record them, and this was really old school stuff. We would record them live to tape. There was no editing, no post-production done.
Once it's done, it might as well be done. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
It's on tape, and it's ready to go. And that's how they did things. It was old school live to tape back then.
Who were the big stars at that point in time?
Ric Flair, Dusty Rhodes. Dusty was the booker back then. The Road Warriors were big stars. Michael Hayes was a big star of ours. Jimmy Garvin, Ron Garvin. Jim Cornette in the Midnight Express and the Rock and Roll Express. Magnum T.A. right before his injury, because he was injured in 86.
I mean, that's a hell of a crew. In the Carolinas and the Georgia area,
right.
Drawing big houses.
And now that we're on TBS, they decided to go national. So we started booking Philadelphia, running Philadelphia, Baltimore, Cincinnati, even went out west. And I would go out west with, and it was pretty good. It was a pretty good, I thought, idea by Jim Crockett that when we would go on tour, now we were, again, mostly a Virginia and Carolina outfit, but when we go on tour, like out west or somewhere, they would send me as the ring announcer because I was the announcer they saw on TV. So it was kind of special to see those stars and then see me be the ring announcer as well. So I traveled as a ring announcer for a couple of years with the guys.
Did you ever travel on the plane?
Oh, yeah.
So what was that like? So Crockett bought a private plane.
Yeah, two of them.
To fly the whole crew back and forth.
Yeah, he did. And it was creepy. It was scary at one time. I remember this one time they had the Gulfstream, which I think carried maybe like 15 guys, and they had what they called the Falcon, which was kind of like the big stars plane that Jimmy Crockett would go on, Dusty would go on, Flair would go on, and that was about it. The Gulfstream would be the rest of us, and one time we dropped in altitude, big drop, and Jim Cornette screamed like, as we're going down, and Hawk said, "You almost died there." He said, one more scream and I was going to just wring your neck. I never forget that because when he screamed, he just freaked us all out. And Cornette's always was a terrible flyer.
He hates flying, yeah.
Oh,
you won't fly pretty much now.
Really, yeah. Drives just about everywhere. I know. I saw him in Allentown, Pennsylvania. He had driven from Louisville, Kentucky to Allentown for an autograph signing.
Right.
I said, man, things don't change. But he shrieked and he screamed and Hawk was going to kill him. But we all flew in the Falcon or I flew in the Falcon some, but most of us in the Gulfstream. And I guess that was one of the things that really was the downfall of Jim Crockett Promotions, because those were so expensive. Those airplanes were just...
Seems like such a ridiculously crazy idea to do that.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, easy way to travel, but lots of money.
Yeah, I can't see how... And they had one guy running the books, right? One book guy. As far as one accountant. So it was a real small-time mom-and-pop organization. It really was. And in reality, it could not compete with Vince. And so when they sold to Turner Broadcasting in 89 or at the end of 88, Vince got in touch with me and offered me a job. And I went up there and started working with him. And I walked into Vince's production facility thinking, oh, my God, this is how you really do things. This is big time TV.
When I left WCW to go to WWE, and I always say this with the utmost respect, because I'm not one of those guys who buries WCW. I really enjoyed my time there. But it was literally like Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
Where it's black and white in WCW land, right. And then you go to WWE land, and you open the door, and it's color, and it's just... I couldn't believe the difference in professionalism and just the way that it ran as this well-oiled machine.
Right.
And I thought about, like, for guys like Nash and Hall and those guys, how would it be to go back to the black and white?
Right.
After you've been up there.
I went back to the black and white.
Well, before we talk about that, what were some of the differences that you noticed when you first went to Vince?
Well, first of all, I noticed that they had post-production and they actually edited a show together and they had staff. In other words, they had people in place to make it work. I was a producer for the video cassettes back then, Coliseum Videos. I had an assistant and a secretary. and we never had that staff at all. When we did TV, we had backstage pre-production interviews. We never did that. They would go back and they would, I don't know if they still do this or not, but in the bigger venues, they would build these little sound booths to do interviews in.
Yeah, the box. Yeah.
The box. You know, they would do English 1, English 2. And it was like, it was really the big leagues to me. And I thought, man, this is the place to be.
Were you on-air talent as well?
Yeah, I did. I started doing a wrestling challenge. They had two I don't know if they still have this or not. They had two syndicated shows, WWF Superstars and WWF Challenge.
They don't, but I remember watching Superstars and seeing you for a short period of time and knowing you from the wrestling magazines because we never got that, the WCW in Canada. Yeah,
and I was working with Gorilla Monsoon, and they had me do two pay-per-views. Okay. I did SummerSlam 89 with Jesse Ventura, and I did Royal Rumble 90 with Jesse Ventura.
Wow, as the lead commentator.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So we have to talk about what it was like with working with Gorilla Monsoon. But before we get to those stories with Tony, have any of you Sexy Beast listeners given Omax Cognitive Boost a try yet? You got to go do it. Go to omaxboost.com/Jericho. And I'm telling you, Omax is going to be your best friend this holiday season. Omax is going to help you enjoy all the holiday parties, not miss a day of work, get all your shopping and wrapping done, and not get run down and tired in the process. Listen, we're all living a fast-paced, multitasking, rock and roll lifestyle these days, going a million miles a minute, juggling work, family, fun, needing to be razor sharp and at the top of our game all the time. Even I get tired and run down sometimes with all the travel I've been doing, touring with Fozzy around the world, wrestling for New Japan. I got days where I'm a little foggy and unfocused, don't know where I am, don't have that energy, and throw some vodka on top of that, those hangovers just make it worse. And sure, listen, I've used coffee, energy drinks, all that stuff gives you temporary boost, but there's no amount of caffeine that's going to improve your brain's ability to think fast, communicate, and fire on all cylinders. That's where Omax Cognitive Brand comes in for me, helps my focus, keeps me crystal clear and sharp so I can handle everything happening in my life, even when my fogginess is hangover related, which happens more than I'd like. Omax Cognitive Boost is a 100% certified and tested supplement that'll keep you at your peak performance by boosting your memory and your energy input. And 4 out of 5 people say that staying sharp is their number one priority as they start getting older. So if you're looking to improve your memory, yes, and experience sharper and faster thinking, yes, give Omax Cognitive Boost a try. And I'm going to make it real easy for you to experience what I'm experiencing, because right now Omax is offering all of you Sexy Beast Talk is Jericho listeners 60% off a 1 month supply of Cognitive Boost plus free shipping and a 60-day money back guarantee. Just go to omaxboost.com/Jericho. That's omaxboost.com/Jericho and get 60% off a 1 month supply today. Remember, Omax has two powerhouse ingredients, Alpha and Omega. I'm not talking about Kenny and Jericho. I'm talking about Omega 3. It's what Omax does. It takes the Omega 3, which is critical to brain health and supporting cognitive function, and combines it with Alpha GPC, which is key to faster neurotransmission. Pretty technical stuff, right? These two together improve your mind-body connection, which we all need. And all of the ingredients in Omax are safe, natural, and backed by years of clinical research. So optimize your body and mind. Try Omax Cognitive Boost today and take advantage of the 60% off your first month supply. All you gotta do is go to omaxboost.com/Jericho. That's omaxboost.com/Jericho. 60% off your first month supply, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. It's all you need. Do something good for your mind and body, okay? Go to omaxboost.com/Jericho now. omaxboost.com/Jericho. Terms and conditions do apply. Go check it out now.
First of all, how was it working with Gorilla Monsoon?
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the great men of all time. Gorilla had been a play-by-play guy until I stepped in, and they moved Gorilla over as a color guy. And he was just so, he was so good to me as far as telling me what he thought Vince liked and how he thought Vince liked his announcers. And he instructed me. He really did. I had a lot of affection for him and what type of guy he was. Just a wonderful guy. So it was great working with him.
Because at that time, Vince was also commentating.
Yes.
Because I know he liked to be commentating because he could really, you know, tell the angles that he wanted to tell. Right. So to allow you to do it was kind of a big step for him.
And when Vince hired me, he said, I want you to eventually replace me. I want you to be the guy to come in and do Saturday night's main event. He said, I want you to be our lead announcer. He said, that's what I envisioned for you. And then I think, and Bruce Prichard was my boss at that time, I think I fell out of favor with Vince. Vince, according to Bruce, thought I had kind of a very Southern type twang to my voice. And he wanted me to work on that. There's a rumor out there that he sent me to voice lessons.
Diction school?
Yeah. He did not do that, but I would have loved that. If someone would have paid that for me to go to because I am from the South, and I did work hard on changing my voice throughout the years. That never happened, but he kind of fell out of favor because I did SummerSlam. I did not do the Survivor Series. They put Gorilla back in there to do Survivor Series because mm-hmm. that's back when they just had four pay-per-views. Mm-hmm. So I did SummerSlam of 89. He took me off Survivor Series of 89. And then Royal Rumble in January of 1990 was in Orlando, Florida. And Vince was going to do the commentary, Jesse. Again, second straight pay-per-view where apparently he's lost confidence in me. And he's not going to let me do pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. Not going to let me do Royal Rumble. We were in Orlando, Florida. And we had scheduled a noon production meeting in Orlando at the old Orlando Arena. And Vince was late. And he had been down in Boca. He and his family and his friends had been down in Boca having a great weekend. So they were late. The production meeting ended up beginning like at 1:30 or 2 o'clock. And I never will forget, he walked in, he sat down at the table, and he said, "I don't want to do this today." He looked at me, he said, "You got your tux?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You're doing play-by-play with Jesse." Hmm. So just because he had such a such a bang-up weekend at Boca,
right.
He didn't want to do the commentary. So I did the commentary for the Royal Rumble. And that began the Hogan Warrior angle kind of leading to WrestleMania 6.
Wow. And yeah. You were the voice of it. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
How was it like working with Jesse?
Great.
He's still probably, well, you had, and we'll talk about the brain too.
Yeah.
You had probably
sure.
two best color commentators yeah. of all time.
I've been fortunate, yeah.
Working with both of them as right. almost their straight man in a right. lot of ways.
I was really starstruck with both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And especially Jesse, because I had watched Saturday Night's Main Event and watched some of the stuff that he did. And I just felt really starstruck, you know, working with him. And
he was almost the prototype for the heel commentator.
Oh, yeah.
That they still try and do to this day.
Exactly. He was the man. He absolutely was. And, you know, if you go back, and when I worked for Vince, I had a chance to do this work, going back in the library and looking at the old Saturday Night's Main Event that he, that was some classic, great stuff that they did back then. So being able to work with him, and then of course Jesse came to WCW later in the 90s, and I was able to work with him on pay-per-views there too. So yeah, it was great. You know, I often joke about the fact that when Jesse and I were working together in WCW, we'd travel together, and we'd fly somewhere and I'd get a car, and I often joke about I was the chauffeur for the governor of Minnesota long before he really had a chauffeur.
No kidding, right?
Yeah.
But something I want to ask you, because you were, you know, at the desk for this huge period of wrestling that had some of the biggest stars of all time.
Right.
You know, including, like, when you're talking WCW, I say WCW, I know it was Jim Crockett Promotions.
But, sure.
Just using it as a blanket term. The biggest babyface was Dusty?
Or yes.
And then obviously you're talking about Hogan in WWE. What was the difference between the two pops in the arenas?
I still say today, and people ask me this, what's the biggest day of wrestling that you've ever called, the biggest event you've ever called? And I did SummerSlam, like I said, I did Royal Rumble. But still, to me, the biggest day that I've ever had in wrestling was when I first called a match at Madison Square Garden.
Mm.
Was Hogan and Boss Man in the cage. And Lord Alfred Hayes and I did the MSG broadcast. And I had been, you know, I had been on some big events with Jim Crockett, but that was an experience like none other. Mm. And we did the broadcast, and Hogan did the superplex off the top of the cage with the Boss Man. And then we got into a charter and flew to Boston. And that night did the Boston Garden on NESN Sports Network. That's, to me, the greatest day I've ever had in wrestling. Still is, and I've done a lot of big events. But there was nothing like Hogan and the babyface run that he has. I mean, there was nothing like it. It was like...
because I was in the ring with him in 2002. I worked with him for about 6 months.
Right.
And obviously, it's 15 years down the line from the peak.
Right.
But even so, Hogan yeah. coming out got a reaction
yes.
that was rivaling, you know, The Rock at the time, or whoever
sure.
you want to put in that position. I can just imagine what he must have been like in the 80s,
yeah.
89 or so.
Yeah. And, you know, he followed wrestling. He followed me with Jim Crockett Promotions. And he was very, very nice to me when I first came to the WWF. It's something I'll never forget because he was the biggest star. We happened to have, I upgraded one time and we sat on a flight together to Arizona and talked for a long time and I got to know him.
Mm-hmm.
But just doing that match at Madison Square Garden and seeing Hulkamania, you know, and we would do TV. We would go out and do Superstars or Challenge or whatever, and they wouldn't bring out Hogan till the end of the night, and the fans would wait on him, mm-hmm. you know, a long, long time.
And he, and his matches were never on TV either.
Right. It was the dark match. The final match that you would come to see.
Yeah.
Right. So it was quite an era.
What and led you going back to WCW then?
Well, it was a lot of things. Okay. I had told Vince that I was in for the long haul, and I really thought I was. Our children were, we had five children, and the oldest was five. Of five children.
Okay. Holy smokes.
So
you guys were busy.
We're not kidding. We were busy. So we needed a house for five children, and we could not afford a house in Connecticut.
Super expensive.
Oh, man. My God.
Yeah.
So we were renting a house, and I was really having struggling making ends meet, but I was still making pretty decent money. Mm-hmm. I didn't have enough for a down payment for a house. And my wife was pretty miserable, but she was the type of, and is the type of person that says, you know, we'll stick it out if you want. And so it wasn't right for my family. And Jim Barnett called me. I don't know how he found my number. Called me on my house phone and said, we'd like to talk to you. So I went to New York City, met them at the Grand Hyatt. He and Jim Herd at the Grand Hyatt. And they offered me not double but close. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't turn that down. I absolutely could not turn that money down and moving back to the South, being able to buy a house.
Gotcha.
And so it was kind of it was just a financial decision that I had to make.
And you feel Vince was not happy with it?
Oh, he was really angry at first. Yeah. And then when I went into his office like a week later, or maybe 2 weeks later to sign, you know, the waiver, you know,
the release.
My release, he was very nice to me then. Door's always open for you to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So we parted on very good terms, but the day that I announced that I was leaving, he was very, very unhappy.
Let's talk about WCW when it started becoming a viable contender, because, you know, those early 90s were some rough years for WCW, and actually for Vince too. It wasn't super hot, but suddenly, you know, tell us what it was like when Eric Bischoff took over.
Yeah, well,
and the vision that he had.
Eric took over. There were three of us in the running to take over the company.
Really?
Yeah.
Three of us, meaning yourself.
Right, yeah.
Wow.
Me, Keith Mitchell, and Eric Bischoff.
No, Keith as well.
Yeah.
Keith is a longtime director.
Right.
For Nitro.
Right.
And kind of the Kevin Dunn of WCW.
I think he's been working for Impact too.
Okay, right. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
Eric really wanted the job. I really didn't. there's also... on the internet that Tony really wanted the job. Even Kevin Sullivan said Schiavone was heartbroken when he didn't get the job. I wasn't, because Chris, I never thought WCW was in it for the long haul.
Mm-hmm.
I just did not see, I didn't, and we were hot at one time, but when Eric was vying for the job and Bill Watts had left, I really didn't see any future in it. And of course, Eric gave it a future.
Sure, you know, yeah. Because that's pre-Hogan, pre-NWO.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly.
Right.
We were doing some good things, but I just didn't think that I could turn it around. Bill Shaw, who was the guy at Turner Broadcasting, who everybody answered to, had told me, he said, I've got a proposal from Eric, and I got a proposal from Keith Mitchell. I haven't heard from you yet. I said, okay, so I typed up something like 5 or 6 pages or whatever. And
what was your proposal?
I can't even remember. My proposal is I'll take a 5-year no-cut contract and I'm out of here. and Eric got it because he really wanted it. And Eric and I were very good friends. So he had ideas in place. He really had ideas in place. And I remember him telling me that he's got a big idea that he thinks will really jumpstart this company if Turner will go for it. And what that eventually was offering Hulk Hogan a contract where he has full control over his character or full control over what he does.
Right, and then the huge percentage of pay-per-view buy rates and
exactly.
basically the keys to the company.
Yeah, exactly. So, but the key was that he could offer Hogan what Vince could not offer him and would not offer him, and that is full control
over creative control.
Creative control.
Wow.
And I didn't know he was talking about Hogan, but I knew he had something big in mind. So, of course, it was Hogan.
What you mentioned if Turner would go for it. It was, you mean the Turner execs or Ted Turner himself?
I'm thinking the Turner execs. Mm-hmm. Ted was really hands off.
Yeah, yeah. I never, I mean, right. not that I would have seen him. I was right. just a low life guy. But, right. I mean, did you ever see him around at all? Did he ever come to the shows?
Never came to the shows. Yeah. He met with us as a company Christmas time in 1991 mm-hmm. or 92. Just like we went to the Omni Hotel at a ballroom. He came in and
smiling wave.
Smiling wave. Yeah. And he said, I know we're losing money. He said, but, you know, hell, CNN lost money all these years. So we're hanging with this. Don't worry about it. And everybody clapped. And I never will forget that Big Van Vader said, Mr. Turner, could I have your autograph? I'm thinking, come on, Leon. Quit being such a big baby. I mean, he was like a little kid. Mr. Turner, could I have your autograph? So that was the only time we saw him. The only time. Now, I'm sure that Eric and Bill Shaw had contact with him.
Sure, right.
But he was more
when
like
you get to that level, there's probably, you know, 30 or 40 different companies or, you know, legs of his business that he's dealing with.
Right. You know? Yeah, exactly.
What was the impact when Hogan first came in? Was it big, or because he was kind of a little bit like people weren't as crazy for him at first, or maybe as the time went on, from what I recall?
Well, I think that there's no question that it put a lot of attention on us. Mm-hmm. There's no question that if you go back and look at what we were doing business-wise, buy rates and gate receipts before Hogan and after Hogan, it really ticked up. I don't think there was any question.
Because it was a huge coup at the time. I mean, Hulk was still very, right. very big, very popular.
Right. And we got the match that everybody wanted, Ric Flair and Hulk Hogan.
The match that Vince never did.
That's exactly right.
As crazy as it sounds, right?
Exactly. So we did it in Bash at the Beach in 1994. We got Shaquille O'Neal to walk out with Hulk. Mm-hmm. I did the play-by-play. That day I did half the show with Jesse and half the show with Bobby the Brain Heenan. Mm-hmm. And it was a sign of really things to come for us, I thought, to a certain extent. I always had this on the back of the mind, and you were talking about Ted Turner. The difference is that there was Vince, and it was his money, and it was his company. And he was the buck stopped there. With Turner Broadcasting, you never knew where the buck stopped.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Remember the nickname was ATM Eric.
Yeah.
Bischoff, you know, because he would always even say, like, it's not my money.
Right.
You know, I'll give you this. It's not my money.
Sure.
Whereas with Vince, it's every penny's his money.
You're damn right. And so it's much different.
Right.
Any of us who've been in business and who've worked in the business knows when it's your money, it's so much different. So that's where that was one of the things when I go back and think about Tony Schiavone running the company, it wasn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. It really wasn't going to happen.
Because even knowing who the boss is, I mean, in WCW, once again, the Wizard of Oz theory, like coming into WWE 99, you know who the boss is for every single aspect. And to this day.
Yes.
I remember we had an app for a while, and you had to do these 30-second app things, and Vince would still want to approve it. Mm-hmm. Whereas WCW... Is it Eric? Is it Hulk? Is it Kevin and Scott? Is it, you know,
right.
Macho Man? Is it Sullivan? Who's calling the shots?
Right.
And in some cases, everybody.
Exactly. You know? It was a mess. It was a mess. Even before that, I'll tell you a very short story about my transition back to WCW or out of the WWF.
Right.
I left and I really didn't want to professionally, but as I said, I had to.
Yeah.
I came back. And my first day in, they took me down. They said, well, we got this new production facility here at the CNN Center. We want you to take a look at it. And it was it looked like a closet. Okay. All right. I was so miserable. My very first day back, I called Vince. Emily. Yes. Emily Feinberg was his secretary. And I said, Emily, I need to talk to Vince. She said, what's wrong? I said, I want to come back.
Wow.
She said, what? I said, I've made a big mistake. I said, this place is just not going to last. And I said, she said, well, I'll talk to Vince. Mm-hmm. And she called me back and she said, Vince said, you got all those small kids. You just moved your family. We were living in Charlotte when we worked for the Crockett's. You just moved your family from Charlotte to Connecticut and now Connecticut to Atlanta a year later. He says, keep your family there and stay there and make it work. But I was miserable. My wife can tell you that I cried. I sit on the couch and cried, thinking that my life has come to an end. Yeah. It was terrible at first, just absolutely terrible.
But then WCW started getting really hot, right? And I want to hear how that started. But before we talk about Hulk Hogan and the NWO, let's talk about another WCW alum that both Tony and I know very well, who went on to have a tremendous post-wrestling career. Talking about Diamond Dallas Page. Dallas has worked wonders with his DDPY program for so many people, myself included. Changed my life. Made it possible for me to still wrestle at the highest of levels and tour the world with Fozzy. Dallas saved me from back surgery. I know I talk about it all the time, only because it's the truth. Three different doctors said I needed back surgery to repair the herniations in my discs. I said no. I started doing DDPY. I'm completely cured. I started with the DVDs. I used to travel with them. Sometimes I still do. I'm old school that way. But now I've got the DDPY Now app on my phone, so I can do it wherever I am. Right now it happens to be in Calgary, wrapping up Fozzy's worldwide Judas Rising tour. After 19 months, we played the last show last night in my former hometown, and Fozzy guitar player Rich Ward and I actually did DDPY in the dressing room before the show, and we've been doing it pretty much every day on the Canadian tour. People love Dallas's DDPY program. He's so sure that you will too. I'm so sure. He's giving you a 7-day free trial now. All you gotta do, download the DDPY Now app and get started. And I'm not just talking about free access to the workouts. I mean, you can try everything the app has to offer for free for 7 days. Hundreds of workouts, live workouts with an instructor from the DDPY Performance Center in Smyrna, Georgia. That's where we filmed the Judas video. Almost 25 million views on that on YouTube. And you can connect up a Bluetooth heart rate monitor to the app so you can track your progress. You can check out all the recipes and nutrition tips that Dallas has on the app to help you eat healthier. I know you've heard me say it over and over again, but DDP Yoga really is a kick-ass cardio program that's going to improve your flexibility and strengthen your core. I am proof that this works. So start your free 7-day trial now, ddpyoga.com/Jericho. You got nothing to lose and everything to gain. And Dallas has even extended his big Black Friday sale. He's offering 30% off the DDPY workouts and the DDP Now app. This is the biggest sale ever on the DDPY program. So don't miss your chance to get started on DDPY. And yes, you still get 3 months for free on the app with any DVD program purchase. You go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho to get this special site offer. 30% off the DDPY workouts and the DDPY Now app. If you go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho. And if you're really struggling to get started on the DDPY program, then you need to pre-order Dallas's upcoming book, Positively Unstoppable, The Art of Owning It. It's filled with lessons from DDP's life that share his own personal struggle to find his calling and overcoming one obstacle after another. Unstoppable is a Bible for anyone who needs to be re-inspired to follow their dreams and take real action towards the things that matter most to them. Listen, you got to read this inspiring story. They told Dallas he'd never wrestle again. He created DDP Yoga and then won the world title 3 times. So you got to check out his book, Positively Unstoppable. It's out January 15th, 2019, but you can pre-order it now anywhere books are sold. And don't forget, ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Get in the best physical and mental shape of your life and do it now.
Let's talk about when WCW started getting really hot.
Okay.
And I think probably the caveat was the NWO.
Sure.
To me, I'll explain in a second. Because to me, it was always the NWO, but I also think it was the advent of the quote-unquote cruiserweight style.
Sure.
Meaning guys who could really work.
That's right.
You know, I mean, to this day, Seth Rollins and Roman Reigns is cruiserweight style, if that's what you call it.
Because, right.
But when you're talking about the NWO and the whole concept of it, how much of it was a secret to you guys? Like, were they – because Eric had a tendency to try and work the boys, mm-hmm. and you guys calling it as well. Were you mm-hmm. guys in on this? Did you know?
You're talking about when Hulk Hogan turned?
What's that?
You talk about when Hulk Hogan turned heel?
When you knew Hall and Nash were coming in.
Right.
Right.
Because
that was the whole big impetus for it. But talking about Hulk turning heel and just the whole concept of the beginning of the NWO.
Well, it first started when Scott Hall walked in on one of our broadcasts. Didn't know that.
You didn't know he was coming.
Didn't know he was coming in.
So what are you thinking when you see Scott Hall?
I'm thinking, well, now, of course, we have Hogan now, right? He's been with us for a little while. I'm thinking, well, you know, the shit's on now.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this guy. And even before that, if you'll recall, they had Luger on the first Nitro.
Right.
Right. And the same thing happened with Rick Rude. I mean, they just pulled these guys away.
Medusa.
They
throwing the belt in the trash.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
But when Hall walked in, who was Razor Ramon, who was a big star, I'm thinking, you know.
Shit's on. Right.
And it really was. And then, of course, Kevin Nash came on. And I was not doing commentary at that time.
Were you doing like more backstage interviews?
More backstage interviews and stuff. Because Eric was doing Nitro back then. I didn't start doing Nitro till Eric turned heel and became a part of the NWO.
Mm-hmm.
But that was like, we never knew that was happening.
Hmm.
And now when Hogan turned heel, that was quite a day. Because we had heard so much, so many different things.
There was a rumor that you knew there was going to be a third guy,
mm-hmm.
but no one knew who it was. Yeah.
I mean, we thought Bret Hart.
Mm-hmm.
We thought maybe Hogan.
Or you thought maybe?
Yeah, yeah, because you heard so much. I mean, I think they threw the rumors around backstage just to try to throw you off
base. Red herrings.
Exactly, to throw you off base. So if you go back and watch that, when he walks out in his, you know, his regular Hulk Hogan stuff.
Yellow and red.
And I was like, I remember walking out thinking, is it him or is he going to clean house or, you know, what's he going to do? And I didn't know. And then, of course, when he started his, which will go down as one of the great heel turn promos ever.
Yeah.
Then we realized, you know, it was that. So they really kept us in the dark.
So you're calling it. For real,
right.
Natural reaction.
Exactly.
Hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Natural reaction. Had no idea what was happening. And I was pretty shocked because we're talking about the biggest baby face in the business turning heel.
Yeah, for basically the first time ever.
Right, exactly.
But the thing I loved about Hulk, and this is something the Flair versus Hogan debate, and listen, Flair, you can't say enough about him, but for me, I worked with Hulk as a babyface and Flair as a babyface. Mm-hmm. And Flair is not a good babyface, whereas Hulk is Hulk.
Right.
But Hulk was also a great heel as well.
Yes, he was.
He really knew how to play that character,
right.
And he embraced it.
Right.
And he made it work. He made the whole NWO work.
Right. He said during the interview, and I've seen it a couple of times since then, and this was great ad lib. He said, fans, if you'll recall, it's a very big deal. Fans, very well known in wrestling, fans started throwing trash into the ring. I don't know if that was planned or not. You know, you never know.
Right.
They always try to work you, right? fans started throwing trash in the ring, and Hulk Hogan says, I feel like you fans are just like this trash here. And I thought that was such a great ad-lib. It was such a great heel ad-lib. And
he also said you fans can go to hell.
Yeah.
Like Hulk Hogan, they'd eat your vitamins and say your prayers and drink your milk, telling you to go to hell.
Right. Exactly.
Like, oh my gosh.
Right. Exactly.
I was in the business and it still like
made
me feel strange.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Yeah. And then I said at the end of it, I said, Hulk Hogan can go straight to hell.
Oh, you said, yeah.
At the end of it. And that was a line that I didn't, they didn't give it to me because I was trying to think, man, I got this great superhero, right? And he's turned, what can I say?
So
that's what I said at the end of
the classic line.
So it was a lot of it was a memorable night. I mean, and it started things, right? It started it started the NWO run,
which just blew the whole doors off.
But I kind of think here we're sitting in 2018 and everybody does armchair quarterbacking, right? I think they really watered it down a lot in efforts to make it big.
As far as adding too many guys?
Yeah, too many guys who really... listen, it's not a slap on Mike Jones. It's not a slap on Buff Bagwell.
And Mike Jones, a.k.a. Virgil. When Virgil got in the NWO, you're like, okay.
Yeah, I'm thinking, they run his ass out, and I think, what's going on here, okay?
Right.
And Scott Norton, you know, those guys were good competitors, but they weren't up there with Hogan and Nash and Hall or the Macho Man Randy Savage.
Mm-hmm.
So it watered it down, and... And then it became what it became. But you were talking about the cruiserweight division, and that was another thing too. You know, with yourself and Malenko and Rey Mysterio, and
it was just, Eddie and Benoit and Hoovy and like all those guys.
We go back and watch some of those old tapes, Chris, and it's amazing the talent that we had.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah, just.
I think I always say, like, you know, at the time, not always say it's not a revolutionary thing, but that WWE had great main events, but the undercard was not good.
Right.
We had a great undercard.
Right.
And even though the main events weren't good, they were always, you know, it's Piper versus Flair. And it's Hogan, you know, but most of those matches were not good.
No, you're right.
But the undercard was enough to go like, shit, well, the main event sucked.
Right.
But the undercard was great.
Exactly.
But the main event got all the steam and all the credit for it. You know?
Exactly. You're right. Because the main event was based on notoriety.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knew Piper. Everybody knew Hogan. Everybody knew Flair. They were the big established stars. But we could open up a show, you know, with some great stuff.
For sure.
Yeah. And that's what we didn't have. I was just watching Wrestle War 91. This is before NWO and before all the cruiserweights. The opening match on Wrestle War 91 was Ricky Morton, Tommy Rich and the Junkyard Dog against the State Patrol and Big Cat Curtis Hughes.
Right.
That was the opening match. Now compare that to like Chris Jericho and Juventud Guerrero. Right.
Right? I mean, kicking off your show better, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's a great way to kick off a show, and you open up the show thinking, man, we're on our way now.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was a great time for us.
Did you, like, when you're talking about commentating for Vince, I know he's in the ears of the commentators now.
Yeah.
Was he then?
No.
Oh, okay.
Thank God. I mean, I've heard stories, yeah. You know. Bruce Pritchard was in my ear.
Okay, but somebody was in your ear.
Yes.
Because WWE had the gorilla position.
Right.
Which was kind of the control center.
Yeah.
WCW did not.
No.
There was a curtain.
Yeah.
And then 20 feet down the hall would be Jody Hamilton with right. a stopwatch and a microphone. 5 minutes.
Right.
Sitting at a basically like a church wooden table.
Yeah, I know.
That you would like put somebody through nowadays.
Exactly.
That was it.
That was it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's another great.
Unbelievable to think that that was how it was.
Yeah, I know. But Bruce was at the gorilla position, I believe, and talking in my ear. And we never had that in WCW until after you left. Mm. In like 2000, 2001, they would put Terry Taylor in my ear.
Okay.
Which was a train wreck.
Yeah.
Because Terry, to his credit, was trying to do a lot. And he would say, he would have the headset on and be listening to me. And then somebody would come about their match. He would take the headset off and talk to a guy about their match, right? Mm. And then he'd put the headset on and he'd give me a line that I had just said.
Yeah.
Okay. And we go to a commercial break. I said, Terry, put Terry on headset. I said, I'll say anything you want me to say, but damn it, listen to my commentary.
Right.
So that it never worked the way it worked with Bruce and me. And of course, now I guess Vince does it now with the guys.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad I missed that because I understand it can be pretty brutal.
Were you like in the production meetings? Did WCW have production meetings?
Oh, yeah.
Show? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Right. We especially had production meetings when Vince Russo arrived.
Mm.
They were more like the Vince McMahon production meetings.
Well, because he had come straight from WWE.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And he laid out the whole show. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking, wow, this is the way to do things. This is how I remember 1989, you know, mm-hmm. the guy running the production meeting and a guy knowing what he wants. Before then, we would have production meetings, but we would just kind of read down a show.
Right.
And it wasn't really anything detailed. And I can't remember the years, but it had to be 98, 99, especially 99 and 2000, where we would have production meetings and then they would change everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand, look, I understand that's the way all entertainment is. I know that in Hollywood, they have rewrites all the time, right? So things change on the fly. But we would have so many changes that there were many nitros that I started the show without a format.
I remember.
Yeah, because they pulled them back from me.
And I remember one time they put Big Boss Man mm-hmm. and Psychosis out for three segments to start the show because they were still writing it.
Exactly.
Yeah, they would change, or Hogan wouldn't like something.
Right.
Or once again, full creative control on his stuff.
Right.
And probably everybody else's too, if he wants there to be.
Exactly.
But like three segments as they're furiously writing the show, and you guys are there commentating.
We're doing the commentating. We don't know what to say, where to go, what what to promote coming up. And then they would have Annette bring out like a segment four or segment. And sometimes she would bring them out segment by segment.
Wow.
By segment.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, that happened a lot. So, I mean, so it.
And this is live TV.
It's live
just
TV.
Just so people understand, there's 5, 6, 7, 8 million people watching this show.
Right.
That's being written segment by segment.
Yeah. So it was a challenge. I relished the challenge, you know, of trying to, you know,
you
do it on the
good.
Fly.
Yeah.
You got to do it on the fly. You got to try to make it. But the more disorganized it got in the backstage, I think you could see that on TV.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. Three segments of a match, right?
Right, for sure.
Right.
What was it like working with Bobby the Brain Heenan?
Bobby was tremendous. You know, Bobby and I had a big blow up, but prior to that, he and I were pretty good friends, and we traveled, and he was so hilarious on the road.
Mm.
I mean, he always did practical jokes to make everybody laugh on the road.
You got any examples?
Yes.
Why, yes, I do.
We had a show in Pensacola, Florida, and I can't remember the time. I don't know if you were with us at that time or not, but we had a show in Pensacola, Florida, and we always tried to, the very next day, Heenan was like this, Tanae was like this. I was like this. Lee Marshall. We all tried to take the very first flight out the next day.
Yeah, as early as you can
early get. Early as you can get, just get out of town. And this was back before they put the folio under your door and you could just walk, okay? Mm-hmm. You had to go and check out at the front desk. So we're talking about 4 a.m, okay? A line of people at the front desk at the hotel in Pensacola, right? And there's one person working and we're all, you know, man, we need to get going. Got to catch the flight and everybody's checking out. And there's this guy who is buffing the floor in the lobby. So he had plugged in his orange extension cord right underneath the desk. There was a outlet there. He plugged it right there as we walk up. And Heenan says, "Watch this." So the cord was stretched across. Heenan, unbeknownst to anybody but me, okay, took the cord as we're in line slowly and wrapped it around his left foot, okay? Uh-huh. So now, as he steps towards the front, okay, he trips and falls down and yanks the cord. The buffer comes right out of the guy's hand, comes sliding towards Heenan, and Heenan gets up. He said, "Oh, I'm sorry." He's apologizing. And now he unplugs the cord, and he pulls, we're all watching this all these pratfalls and everything. He pulls it off his leg and he's got it now. And now it's like a python. Okay. He's fighting with the cord. You're trying to wrap it up for the guy. "Oh, I'm so sorry." And finally just throws it down. And he looks at the lady in the front desk. He says, "I'm sorry. It was a long night for us last night." And as he steps forward now, okay, after fighting all this, he trips again. And they've got these brochures and placards, you know, and he knocks all those down. Okay. And this was all like at 4 o'clock in the morning and everybody's like dying. And the people who worked there thought, you know, this poor soul was just a clumsy oaf. But that's the way he did. I mean, he was performing for all of us.
Right, like, right, yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And just once again, just such a great on the spot guy with his one liners. Oh. It's funny to watch after he passed away. I went back and just watched a couple random Nitros just to hear him talking.
Yeah.
And you guys had great chemistry together.
Well, we really enjoyed each other.
Did. You said you had a blow up with him?
Yeah, I had a it was a terrible blow up that was my fault. Oh. Unfortunately, as we went along, Eric put Craig Leathers in charge of production. I don't know if you remember Craig or not.
I do, yeah.
And Craig put me in charge of the announcers. And we had an announcer.
Quotating it.
Yeah, quote, quotes, flying quotes. Which basically meant that as an announcer, I had to sign off on your expense reports. That's all it was. Okay. Right. And they wanted me to do, in the corporate world, they wanted me to do... sit down and talk to him about, you know, do evaluations, which was BS. And I always just wrote the evaluations.
Rubber stamped it.
Yeah, absolutely. So they stopped using Heenan. I guess he kind of fell out of favor with Eric. I'm not so sure.
Well, he started phoning it in big time, too, towards the end. I think right. He lost a lot of interest in what was going on.
Exactly. So they started using him doing the syndicated shows. And one day I was home. I wasn't in the office. And Craig Leathers called me. And he says, "We've just fired Heenan."
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, same with you.
Same
my
thing.
God.
What? Yeah.
So I guess as the guy who's in charge of the announcers, you want me to call him. He said, "No." He said, "I've called him. I've talked to him. But I'm calling you to tell you that he has threatened a lawsuit."
Hmm.
So I'm calling you as your supervisor to tell you to have no contact with him.
Hmm.
So... me being the good corporate boy, right, I just said, okay.
Hmm.
I should have told Craig, yeah, you know what? I won't talk to him. And I should have called him immediately because we were friends. That was the thing that should have been done. Never did it. Never called him. Never talked to him. Hmm. And it really pissed him off.
I'm sure, right?
Yeah. Really angry. As a matter of fact, Lois and I showed up at a place in Roswell, Georgia for, and I don't know what year this was. This was right after it happened. For a New Year's Eve dinner, and he and Cindy were there with Mike Tanay and Mike's wife, and when Heenan found out I was there, he came up to the bar, the other side of the bar, and just stared at me.
Wow.
For like I don't know 20 minutes,
hmm.
And Lois and I were waiting on our table, and I told Lois, I said, "Let's go."
Mm-hmm.
So he was really, really angry at me, and I guess it led to him saying a lot of things about me in his book. I never read his book or online, and I didn't see any of that. But it was my fault. It really was. I did the wrong thing. Yeah. I should have called him. He was my friend, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
We finally in 2003, we finally worked together on a video cassette. I mean, not a video cassette, a video game for Acclaim, and we were in Cincinnati, and you know he was getting sick at that time, and he had trouble talking, and he and I talked for about an hour, and really made up,
shook hands,
and then he got real sick, and he told me, he said, call me. And I'm just terrible about not calling people. And I didn't call him. Mm-hmm. So we did kind of, you know, make up. But the split was my fault because I was such a dumbass.
Right.
I should have never done that.
Well, just doing what your supervisor
said. Yeah. I mean, that's the excuse, I'm sure. But, you know.
When you talk about Vince Russo, and when he came into WCW, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
Because he basically just walked out of WWE and went straight into WCW. And I think a lot of people were thinking, oh my gosh, like this is it, another WCW kind of takeover.
Right.
But it kind of didn't work out that way much.
No.
Why do you think that was?
Because he started to do with us things that he was doing in the WWF. And I think that we became WWF Lite. We were trying to do the same type of TV that he had done there, and the fans had seen there, and they'd done that. I always thought that we should be something completely different than the WWF, and I think we were trying to be too similar to them.
Right.
They had China. We had Asia.
Asia, yeah.
Right. I mean, yeah. So it was just silly stuff that I think just didn't work for the WCW fans. I always thought that we were different.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we were good at one time. But, and listen, I like Vince a lot. I really got along with him. But we were a knockoff.
Is that why you think WCW basically ended up going out of business?
Well, combination of things. First of all, they didn't want us. The new board, you know.
Television network.
Once Ted Turner started selling off or, you know, got moved out, you know, I knew that writing was on the wall once that Turner was out of there.
Yeah, because he had made a proclamation, so to speak, that as long as he was in charge, wrestling would stay on the station.
Exactly.
And then suddenly he's not in charge anymore. Right.
And then, you know, they're sold to Time Warner, then AOL and Time Warner merge or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they have this guy named Jamie Kellner who's in charge, and he doesn't like wrestling at all and announces that wrestling is going to be taken off Turner Broadcasting. And you know, he's the genius that sold the library for $3 million that Vince probably made $3 million in one day on.
I said, if I would have known, like I'm not, you know, a billionaire, but I would have found $3 million
to buy that library.
To buy it. If I had to put everything I had together, I might have been able to come close and borrow a couple bucks here and there.
Exactly.
Because you had $3 million.
Uh-huh.
And I had even heard 2.5 at one point.
Right. Oh, wow. Okay.
And you're like, for that entire library.
Right.
Unbelievable.
I know.
You know?
And there's stuff they got now they still haven't put on the network. They just put Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling on the network. They got Worldwide Wrestling. They got Thunder they haven't put on the network. They've got so much stuff that they haven't put on the network that keeps the network fresh all the time.
Sure.
So it was a combination of that and a combination of really Turner not wanting us.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's Vince's company and it's Turner's company and
difference.
Turner wasn't doing wrestling.
What do you think was the peak of WCW?
The peak of WCW probably was Starrcade of 97 or...
Was that Hogan versus Sting?
Hogan Sting, and the Hogan Sting rematch at Super Brawl the following year.
Mm-hmm.
We were really, really hot. I mean, we were selling out, and we were doing a lot of things, and then of course it started to decline after that. It started going downhill, you know, around the end of 98 through 99. And then 2000, 2001, we were just hanging on.
Well, if you're talking about that Starrcade, that's when they kind of had the wonky finish, too, with the fast count that wasn't fast.
Not at all.
From Nick Patrick.
And I'm supposed to pretend it's the fast count.
Yeah, that kind of makes you look stupid.
Yeah.
And that's kind of your job at times.
Right, to look stupid.
Right.
Yeah, I know. That was a fast count. It wasn't a fast count.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the end of Sting's ascension after a year of build-up because of that.
Right. And then, of course, they had Sting get the title back at Super Brawl the following year. And they were just they were trying. They really were. Mm-hmm. But
well, you know, it's interesting too, because you talk about, you know, looking stupid, and it's the famous quote when the Raw was doing the tape show with Mick Foley, and,
right? You know, yeah,
I mean, Foley's going to win the championship,
right?
What did you think about that? I'm sure you've been asked this a thousand times,
yeah,
but
sure.
I've never asked you before,
right?
Kind of tell the whole story about that night.
Well, the misconception is that Eric told me to say that, which he did not.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
And what he told you to say, or they think, what did you say?
Okay, here's what happened was that night was Eric sent Annette out, Annette Yother, who was like the format girl.
Yeah.
And she became at that time, when Annette would come out, I knew it was something.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it was something from
message.
Eric.
Message.
This is a big message.
Like a Game of Thrones raven.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. The raven lands. Yeah. And yeah. So when she came out that night and we were in a commercial break, so I take the headset off. She said, the WWF is, I don't know if she said either, or getting ready to, I guess, giving their belt to Cactus.
Right.
Eric wants you to really shit on it.
Hmm.
I said, what do you mean really shit on it? She said, you need to say something about how stupid it is for he becoming the world champion. I said, I know when you come out it's something special, but are you sure he wants me to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Because Eric and I had a different vision about things. I always thought we should ignore what the WWF did. He didn't. He always thought we should jab him.
Right.
So she said, no, that's what he wants you to do. So I came up with butts in the seats.
Mm-hmm.
It was my line when I was told to really shit on him. And of course, now that's a famous line. And I'm honored that a lot of people think that I'm the one that changed the business.
Yeah, right.
but I said that. And then, of course, Mick.
Well, you're putting eyeballs onto the product rather
sure we
than
are.
Anything else, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, if I know a world title is going to switch, I'm going to tune it.
Yeah, you're going to watch and see.
You're going to watch and see, absolutely. So I knew it was the wrong thing to do, but I'm also the type of guy that if you tell me to do it, I'll do it, right?
Well, once again, as we've heard, right, exactly.
Yeah. So, look, I'm great friends with JR. I love him. And mm-hmm. he and I still stay in contact. I don't know if he said this afterwards or not. If JR says, I wouldn't have said it, you know.
Yeah.
Bullshit.
Yeah, of course okay. not.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah, you think about all the stuff that Jim's had to do
right,
over the years.
Right, right. You would say it.
Mm-hmm.
I felt bad about it, and I called him. I called him at home.
Oh, did you call Mick?
Yeah, sure did.
What did you say?
He wasn't in it first, and then I said, when I called the second time, he was out. When I called the second time, I said, Mick, you really can't believe that I did that as a shoot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He said, well, I wasn't sure. I said, Mick, I was told by Eric through Annette, you know, to really shit on what you just done. And I've got to do it. And I'm sorry, but I would do it again if I'm told to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, okay, well, I appreciate the call. So, and he was upset. And I don't know.
It's weird to me, though. I mean, you know, I mean, some guys are more sensitive than others,
right?
You know, and to me, it would be like I would totally get that. You know,
sure,
it's
right.
Just business is business.
Yeah,
you don't
right.
really say it or mean it. You know,
right?
Because I mean, there was a lot of arrogance mm-hmm. at that time
mm-hmm.
with Eric, because that's when I think WCW beat WWE in the ratings.
Yeah.
70 weeks in a row or something like
yeah,
that.
Right.
But when it switched,
yeah,
they never went back.
Right.
You know
exactly.
And that was just, you could see the ball,
right.
the sea change. And when it switched, boom, like I said, it was done.
Yeah. Wow.
You know,
I had a lot of power, didn't I? Mm. I did. Were you in the, I bring this up all the time because I know Eric ended up working for Vince.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Were you with us at the Target Center? I never forget where we were.
Mm-hmm.
And when Eric had that meeting in catering, it said he will not rest until he puts a stake through Vince McMahon's heart.
Mm-hmm.
I remember him saying that thinking, holy shit. This is really personal. And the fact that he said that, and you know, if you say that amongst the boys, it's going to get out, right? It's not going to be quiet.
Yeah, but even so, he said it as a team meeting.
Right.
There's exactly. 50 guys in the room.
Exactly.
Right.
And then to see him on Vince's show just blew my mind.
Yeah, it's funny too, because I mean, there's a lot of guys in WCW because it was such a crazy place. Like I, you know, I basically left the same way that you left to mm-hmm. WCW to go to WWE years later,
mm-hmm.
where it was just like, you know, you're offered a certain amount of money, but I'm yeah. leaving anyways.
Right.
And did not really get along with Eric. And when he first came into WWE, I was like, holy shit, like this asshole's got a lot of guts to come in here.
Right.
But then you get to know him, and Eric, outside of that WCW world, was actually a great guy.
Yes.
I really get along with him now. I like him a lot.
Right.
You know, and there's a lot of guys like that. For me, Booker T was like that, Scott Steiner, DDP, right. Big Show. These guys were just miserable.
Right.
So that attitude permeated over to us.
Exactly.
And then you see them outside of it, and they're all just really sweet guys.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, so. I know. The working conditions weren't good.
Mm-hmm.
They really weren't. And there was a lot of pressure on me and a lot of pressure on us. And so when I finally walked away from it cold turkey, I really, really did. I mean, Scott Hudson called me, and Scott always knew the behind-the-scenes stuff. He called me, and he said, I've got a tip that Eric Bischoff is going to be on Raw tonight. And I went,
huh?
Yeah. I got to turn this on.
Right.
I turned it on, and I saw him walk down and shake Vince's hand or whatever he did.
He actually walked through a promo that Booker T was doing.
Oh, really?
And Booker was another guy that wasn't a big fan. And he's, Booker's doing a promo, and Eric just walks right through the shot.
Okay.
And he was like, I don't think he said it, but I know the look on his face was, what the f-?
Yeah,
you know, right. What the hell is he doing here?
Right. So I just turned it off. I said, it's enough. Impact, or back in then, TNA had me come and do a couple of heel things for them, do a couple of heel promos for them. And this was Vince Russo wanted me to work for them.
Right.
And this was probably, I don't know, 2001 or 2002, 2003. And I did like one show for them. And I told Vince, I said, Vince, I just can't do it anymore. I'm completely burned out of the business.
Mm-hmm.
And I completely walked away from it. I want to tell you how completely walked away from the business I was. I did not know about your success, okay, until, I don't know, last year.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting, yeah.
When I put on the, I said, I'm going to watch WrestleMania 18, okay? And I saw the match with you in Triple H, and I went, holy shit, he's in the main event in WrestleMania. And then I went back and watched, you know, when you beat Stone Cold and The Rock,
I'm
thinking, wow, that's a hell of a deal. And I didn't even know what happened.
Right.
Yeah,
you just didn't watch it.
Yeah. So that's, I was just completely removed from it. I mean, I didn't talk to anybody who was in the business. I just completely walked away from it. Had a different life.
Do you watch now or keep?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think of the business now?
Well, I think there's, I like some of the guys. I really, really do. Just everybody fights everybody now.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you? I mean, you see, you know, Roman Reigns will fight, let's say, I don't know, Roman Reigns, for instance, will fight Braun Strowman on a pay-per-view, and then you'll see him fight on a fatal four-way or something the very next night on Nitro. I'm very old school in that, you know, you got to keep them special. You got to keep them apart. And it just seems like everybody's
fighting. So many matches, though, like that started in the Monday Night Wars, where every match has to be somebody versus somebody.
Right.
And the roster's only so big.
Right. And you run out of combinations.
Yeah, that's right.
And I realize.
And out of guys that are truly over as
right,
well.
Right, exactly.
A different thing, too.
So I kind of get lost. And I think a lot of those guys kind of get lost in the shuffle now.
Mm-hmm.
They got a lot of guys who can be big stars, but they're not big stars because they're fighting every, you know, I mean, like, for instance, Kevin Owens, just tremendous, the stuff that he does.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I see him fight every time, every week on TV.
Well, it's like we said earlier, Hogan was never on TV on Saturday night.
Exactly.
Superstars or whatever.
Right.
It was you had to pay to see him, and it was a big event when you did, you know.
Yeah.
As we wind down here, who are some of the best performers that you've ever seen in the ring, like that were your favorites to call the matches for?
Well, obviously, when I was just starting out, Ricky Steamboat was one I really enjoyed. As a young guy just starting out in the business, I really enjoyed watching the Midnight Express against the Rock and Roll Express. Those matches were tremendous. And that was back in the day when, you know, Heat was legit.
Right.
And Jim Cornette was a great heel manager. And, you know,
one of the best. Yeah.
And I really enjoyed seeing their matches.
Mm-hmm.
Magnum TA had some great matches before, you know, before the accident. And I'm thinking old school then.
Sure.
Yeah. But, you know, not just because you and I are sitting here, but the stuff that you did with Malenko.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, and Eddie Guerrero and all that stuff, man, it was great stuff. That turned us around, I think. I mean, that really helped turn us around. The Cruiserweights really meant something, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't watch 205 live now, but I don't know if the Cruiserweights mean as much as they used to.
They don't. And once again, you're dealing with Cruiserweights in name only.
Right.
You know, you had guys that were, you know, guys look like fighters.
Right.
Look like wrestlers. You know, a guy like Benoit was not a cruiserweight, but he was in there with us all the time at 220. I was 225 pounds.
Right.
So I think the cruiserweight basically just meant
You could wrestle.
Guys that could work.
That's yeah. Right. That's
guys
right.
that were doing this new kind of style right. that you exactly. hadn't seen before.
Right.
You know, coming in and being right. so smooth and so, and the acrobatic within a guy like Rey Mysterio, who you'd never seen like a real life superhero.
Right.
You know, and sure. that kind of really wowed the crowds.
Yeah.
You know, along with the star power. So,
right.
Last question. Is there a match that stands out for you that's the best match you've ever called?
Oh, the best match I've ever called?
Yeah.
Wow.
Is there a couple?
Well, the match that stands out for me was Hogan and Boss Man in Madison Square Garden yeah. because it was there.
Right.
You know, and I was... I'd never seen a suplex from the top of
yes.
the cage before.
Crazy with Boss Man, who was 6'8"
right.
and 350 yeah. pounds.
That's the one that kind of stands out to me mm-hmm. more than any. And I get this problem on our podcast, WHW Monday, is that Conrad will ask me all these questions. And Chris, I did so much.
Yeah,
it kind
you forget.
Of just, you do. I mean, you realize that. You just yeah. do so much. And fans remember some of these things.
Yeah.
And we just did it so much stuff that it just kind of all blends in together. The fan, a fan was asking me a question. What did you think about the night the fan crawled up on the, in the cage and came in the cage with Roddy Piper and Hogan? I'm thinking, I better rack that thing up and look at it because I don't
yeah,
remember.
Yeah, yeah.
So
you get those. I saw one on Twitter the other day. It's like, you know, this day in wrestling 16 years ago, and it was me and Kane. No, Kane and Triple H versus me and Kurt Angle. And it's a pretty big match.
Yeah.
I have no I'm watching this match going, I have no memory of this whatsoever. And I am,
yeah.
I remember a lot. Like,
right.
I was never a drug guy. My mind is really good. But
right.
I was like, I cannot remember a damn thing about this match. And that's a main event on Raw with
yeah.
these guys.
Yeah,
but
sure.
You just forget those things after
a
while.
I know, because it's, you know, it's a job to you.
Yeah.
It's
well, and plus there's so many of them.
Yeah, right.
I'm sure that next night there was SmackDown, then uh-huh. there's 2 days off, then we're working somewhere else.
Right.
You know, it's like for you, you're doing Nitro, then you're doing Thunder. And
right.
then, you know, you got to go over here and do the commentary on this. And,
right.
you know, so.
I'll go back and in the same vein, I was watching, one of our last pay-per-views before we went out of business. And I had to go back and watch it because we were going to do a show on it.
Yeah.
And Jason Jett walked out.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea who Jason
yeah,
Jett is.
Yeah.
God bless him. You know, he may have been a great performer.
Yeah.
I don't remember him at all.
Yeah, right. I don't remember
that. I told Conrad, I have no idea who this guy is, but I called his match. Okay.
Tony, it's great seeing you, man.
Thanks, Chris.
And hopefully it won't be another 20 years before we see each other again.
It's great to connect with you. And again, congratulations on your career, buddy.
Thank you, man.
It's been a great one. It really has. And it's still going strong.
Yeah.
It is still going strong,
still going
man.
Strong, man.
Yeah. The stuff you did in Japan recently with Kenny Omega was absolutely wonderful. So,
thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Skiavone.
You got it, man.
All right, thanks again to Tony Schiavone. Tony Schiavone, was great to catch up with him. I hadn't seen him in years. And you guys should subscribe to his podcast, What Happened When. Tony and Conrad break down the stories, the events, and talent from Tony's early days with Jim Crockett Promotions to his run at WCW. If you like 83 Weeks that Conrad does with Eric Bischoff or Something to Wrestle with Bruce Pritchard, go check out What Happened When. You can subscribe for free at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcast. And Tony's also still calling games for the Gwinnett Stripers and doing some work for the Georgia Bulldogs. Follow him on Twitter at Tony Schiavone 24. If you can't spell it, neither could I. Go Google it. S-C-H-I-A-V-O-N-E. Schiavone. Go check him out. And thanks to everyone who came out to see Fozzy on every date of the Judas Rising worldwide tour. 22 countries or somewhere in there, 19 months, about 180 gigs. We appreciate every single one of you came and rock with us. We played our last show last night at the Gateway in Calgary. It was a great place to finish up the tour in my former home city. Thanks, Canada and the entire world, for another great run. And now, time to go back to the studio. We'll see you next time. And we'll see you on Friday when Troma founder and filmmaker Lloyd Kaufman returns to Talk to Jericho. The creator of the Toxic Avenger will be here on Friday. Don't miss that one. Until then, stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy!
The Westwood One Podcast Network.